my assumption remains is that we're going to have a correction sometime this summer going into the election, because Wall Street is not going to want to be long a tremendous amount of assets going into that election, because you don't know who's going to win. You don't know what policies are going to be after they win. You don't know who's going to control the House and the Senate. That has everything to do with policymaking, et cetera. So you don't know what that's going to be. Am I going to get higher taxes, lower taxes, more spending, less spending? And so there's a lot of uncertainty. And so markets are likely going to want to hedge that risk somewhat by taking some gains and raising a bit of cash going into the election. Now, once the election's over, it'll be kind of Katie bar the door again. And I would imagine we're going to get a very strong rally into the end of the year. But sometime this summer, wouldn't be surprised to see that 5 to 10% correction we're talking about.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you back at the end of the week for another weekly market recap with my good friend, the pugilistic portfolio manager, Lance Roberts. Lance, how are you?
What, are we going to go fight here? What's up?
Yeah. Well, that's a nod back to your MMA background, but also you're just a great verbal sparring partner. So I thought it was very appropriate.
Okay, perfect. I like it.
Okay. I've been watching one you like.
I've been watching a lot of action movies lately, so I've been all fired up for the gym. So that's all.
Okay. All right. Well, look, a lot of people are fired up at the end of the quarter here. Yep. Amazing blowout Q1. I mean, just super strong Q1. I'm pulling a text here from dollar milkshake theorist Brent Johnson. He put out yesterday, dollar up, gold up, rates up, Dow up, S&P up, NASDAQ up, Russell 2000 up, everything pretty much went up and went up pretty big in Q1. I think NASDAQ's up, it's up over 25%, over 1,000 points since the low hit at the end of October, right? So, we basically had, what, 4 or 5 months of just explosive growth in asset prices. I want to give quick hats off to some of the folks that called this back in Q4. Had Darius Dale on the program, who said he was the most bullish he'd ever been, given what his model was telling him. We had Michael Howell, the liquidity specialist, who expected Q1 to be a big quarter. We had Felix Zuloff, who said he expected markets and the economy to surprise to the upside in Q1, which they did. I will put an asterisk next to Zuloff's. The other two guys are still pretty bullish, as I understand it. Zuloff had said he expected the end of Q1 to kind of be the high water mark and then the wheels to come off later in the year. We'll see which one of those camps is right. But Lance, how do you feel about this quarter?
Well, no, it's great. You know, we wrote an article back in October talking about the three reasons why we get this rally starting in November, and that was buybacks, extremely negative sentiment, and basically just a reversal of a lot of that negativity we had over the summer. So, you know, none of this is surprising at all. We had a very strong quarter. The quarter was up 10%. Whenever you have that, you know, I just wrote that article recently about gold and Bitcoin and the correlations to stocks that's going on. And again, it's not surprising when you have this much bullish sentiment in the markets. You know, you can come up with all kinds of theses. Well, you know, Bitcoin's doing this because of A, B, or C, and gold's doing this because of X, Y, or Z, whatever it is. You can have all these theses, but what's going on in the markets is that as asset prices go up and speculative fervor increases, everybody starts looking for whatever asset is moving. And so as soon as it starts to move, if I miss the move in the S&P, as an example, and then gold starts to move, I start chasing gold because now that's the new mover. And that's all that's happening in the market. Correlations have gone to one. And over the course of the last month, finally, we're starting to see this rotation from the mega cap stocks into more equal weighted stocks. In other words, now what we're seeing is markets starting to migrate down and go, well, I've chased the artificial intelligence chase as far as I can for right now. So now I'm going to buy utilities and REITs, which haven't moved yet. And so REITs and utilities had a very, very strong week. And in fact, on a relative basis, the most out of favor sector right now is technology. Most overbought is utilities, REITs, and staples, which have been the laggards up to this point. So again, it's just this is how markets work. And we can assign all kinds of theses, and we can say this reason is causing this and this reason is causing that. But that's the psychology of how markets work. And as investors, we're always looking for a reason to assign to something. Oh, this is happening because of A, B, or C. No, it's just that money, there's so much money flowing into the market. It's got to go somewhere. And so as hedge funds and pension funds, et cetera, are needing to place capital, they're just starting to chase whatever moves. And that's when those correlations all go to one.
Okay. So a couple of things. And one, maybe we can pull up some of your charts here, Lance. And sure. If we could, let's start with your chart there, your quadrant of the sector quadrant.
Yeah.
Because the question I want to ask you is, you can make the argument that, man, this market has melted up and prices got really ahead of themselves. And, you know, it was largely driven by the big AI stocks. And we had horrible market breadth for much of the past months of this run. And you could say, okay, this thing is, basically doing a blow off and then it's going to crash back to earth. But you could also say, well, hey, yes, you had the Magnificent Seven kind of lead the charge. But if the market starts broadening out here, then that could be a sign that we can, sustain this momentum, right?
Right.
And it sounds like you're saying, hey, we're beginning to see that broadening out. One of the notes I had here is that energy stocks led the gains in March, which many see as says signs of a broadening market rally. So
right.
I guess my question to you is, are you seeing healthy signs here about this rally?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. We're starting to see that broaden out. We added energy exposure to our portfolio back in January, and I was doing a Fox Business interview with Charles Payne. He's like, why are you buying energy here? I was like, well, there's some catalysts right now with energy that are going to drive energy through the first quarter. And it took about a quarter or so for it to start to work, but it's been playing out very well, ever since. And so let's share the screen here and we can take a look at the quadrant chart. So yeah. So, as you can see, is everything is now moving into the more overbought, more momentum driven. So, once you get into the right two quadrants, you're overbought. And as you start to move up into the upper quadrant, now you're overbought and extremely momentum driven. And so we're starting to see a lot of that beginning to occur. Again, if you remember earlier this year and in October of last year, everything was down on the bottom left. And so right. We've completely reversed, this entire run in the markets. And if we go to look at factors as a function as well, and so we look at all the different types of things that are happening in the markets overall. Just one second, let me build this chart real fast. And this is small cap, mid cap, emerging markets, international markets, core S&P, and just mega cap growth, momentum. It's all clustering now into the overbought quadrant. So basically everything is now moving all at the same time. And that's what I was talking about earlier, is that you can throw anything you want on this chart. It's all in the same set of quadrants at the moment. And that's just the function of the fact that we're now just getting so driven here. Money's got to go somewhere. I've chased the NVIDIAs. I've chased I've chased the AMDs. I've done that. And so now what else can I get into? And it's interesting. We started to launch in January this dividend equity model. It's only half built right now. We've only got about 55% exposure in the portfolio. So it's almost half cash. And that portfolio has been outperforming the S&P over the last couple of days in particular. Because of this rotation. It's only half allocated in its performance.
It's still beating
the S&P. Yeah. So, and again, it just goes to show you that now all of a sudden everybody's like, oh, wow, I haven't been looking at these dividend yielding stocks. I'm going to go buy those now. That's a late stage move, by the way. And so if you go back and look at history and look at when you have 5 months or more, going back to 1900, there's only been 61 occurrences where you've had markets be positive 5 months or more in a row. That's about 25% of the time. And out of that 61, about 30 of them roughly are 5 months or more. So, you know, we're starting to get very long in the tooth in terms of this advance. Now, that doesn't mean the market has a big correction starting, you know, like you're going to go down 10%, you know, the next day. But it generally means you're at least going to have a month where the market cools off a bit. But generally, when you start to see 5 months, 6 months, 7 months in a row of gains in the market, then you typically that's more typical of a late stage move in the markets to where you're going to have a 10% correction. In fact, the last time that I wrote about this was in July of last year, saying, hey, we've had 6 months in a row of an advance. We should have a 5-10% correction here. And then that's what occurred in the summer. So again, it's just, you know, everything's kind of getting very long in the tooth. Every asset class is going to the moon right now. And that's great. Everybody's enjoying it. It's a lot of fun. You don't have to do anything at the moment. You just sit on your hands. That's all we've been doing for the last month. We haven't made any trades in a month. We're just letting markets run right now, because there's not much to do. But at some point, this market's going to break, and then we'll start taking some action at that point.
Okay. And interesting. And I was going to ask this about a minute ago, but you kind of got there, which is I was asking you if it was a healthy sign that the market was broadening at this point. But it sort of sounds like you're saying, well, you know, it's actually more of a late stage signal in terms of the way that it's playing out here. Right. And it is true in this quadrant that you've, the several quadrants you've shown, all the sectors have been on the overbought side, right? So there's really nothing that's oversold right now. Everything's overbought. Capital starting to flow out of the lead sled dogs like the Magnificent Seven and tech into all these other things. But you're saying, hey, history tells us that that's probably right near when the party's about to wind up. So we'll keep watching. By the way, we've been talking about correlations going to one and everything going up, which is pretty true, except we should say not bonds, right? Yields have been going up. So but the somewhat inverse relationship between stocks and bonds has returned, correct?
Not really. Bonds have had a very good week, actually, this past week. And there's actually a very bullish setup that's going on in that. You're building an inverse head and shoulders right now in bonds. This is TLT, so this is bond prices, not yields. But yields actually cracked above the 50, the 100, the 200-day moving average, and the 150-day moving average. They've all clustered together. So you've now broken above pretty important resistance, and you're about to flip onto a what they call a golden cross, which is the 50-day crossing above the 200-day. So behind the scenes, bonds have been doing much better from a bullish perspective, and the setup is becoming much more bullish for bonds here in the short term. Again, PCE today came in a little bit weaker than expected. So inflation continues to kind of moderate here. And if the Fed does cut rates in June or July, then you're looking at, you know, where bonds could see a pretty decent rally. And there's no real resistance. Once we get above this cluster of moving averages, there isn't a tremendous amount of resistance until TLT gets above 100.
Okay. So I want to say, I think we're both right here, which is you're saying the setup is looking bullish for bonds. But if you look back over the past several months, bond prices have largely kind of been declining. They've done it on a slow enough pace that these moving averages have kind of caught up to it and now has the chance to break out above them. And it sounds like you wouldn't be surprised if stocks cooled off here and bonds warmed up, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, and again, that's, they're different asset classes, obviously, but you know, bonds have done very well since the October low. So again, they haven't done a lot in the last month or so, but, you know, since October, they've had a fairly decent rally. And so again, with stocks and bonds, they're kind of all moving in tandem. And it's just, again, this is just kind of the general nature of the markets as things are going up. Everybody's looking for some asset class that hasn't moved yet, and bonds really haven't moved yet. So they, to your point, they may be the laggard catch-up trade if the overall market begins to cool off in the next month or so.
All right. Hey, and let me ask you a question about gold. So gold has finally broken out to new highs. And for the folks that follow gold, and I think we have a high percentage of them in the viewers here, I think there's a question right now of like, you know, hey, is this finally the moment that, you know, we've all been waiting for, where gold really rockets to new highs after years and years and years of trying? And along with that, is this where the much hated gold mining sector, you know, finally gets out of the basement and finally actually starts, you know, rocketing higher because in theory it's supposed to be a leverage play on gold. Could we be there? And because as you said earlier, the market loves momentum, right? So if gold is finally showing momentum, it wants to chase that. And the miners, like I said, have been so hated, but they can move really fast if money flows into that sector, which of course will attract more money. So we have a setup for that. Or do you just think, ah, it's just correlated with capital flows right now, and as soon as the market cools, the activity in gold will cool?
Well, again, no, it will cool with the overall market. So if we get a 5 to a 10% correction in gold prices, just like we did last year, it's going to cool with that. So just like last year when we had the sell-off in the markets, gold sold off with it. Back in 2022, when the market sold off, gold sold off with it. Miners very well, pretty much the same thing. It'll be that same type of environment that, gold miners have not done a whole lot, but unfortunately, every time the market corrects, they correct with them. So again, gold miners have fundamentals, right? Gold miners are fundamentally tied to the price of gold, but then they have human resources, they have operating costs, they have input costs. So it's not just the gold itself. You have to look at the underlying profitability of these miners and the profitability of how the economic environment is going to weigh on that. Gold has no fundamentals whatsoever. It's simply a bet on whatever you want to make it a bet on. It's a bet on inflation, which didn't work out well in 2022, or it's a bet on an economic collapse, which there's no sign of that whatsoever. So as soon as other assets begin to perform better, it becomes a detraction from the price of gold. So gold then sells off and assets go to some other asset class. But that's just the way the markets are working right now. So again, it's just, right now gold's doing great. It's extremely overbought. You're very deviated from long-term means. And so when the market corrects, which is also very overbought, deviated from long-term means, it's all going to correct at the same time. Again,
Okay.
correlations of one.
Yeah. So I don't, again, don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it sounds like you would counsel somebody who's holding precious metals to say, hey, maybe take some gains or maybe put some hedges in place because of the reasons you just mentioned.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, but that's just portfolio management. So if gold is part of your portfolio, which is completely fine, I've got no problem with that whatsoever, then yeah, though, this is the time that you want to take some profits, put in a hedge, shelter some of your downside risk by a put on gold. There's so many ways that you can hedge a portfolio. It's mind-numbing at this point. You can buy a short ETF on gold. So if you're long gold physical, buy a short ETF in your portfolio. So you can hedge your exposure however you want to do it. Just realize that things are going to moderate in alignment with one another because all the correlations over the last 5 years have become so correlated. It's no longer, and there used to be a time back, in the 80s and 90s when Harry Markowitz developed his theory of modern portfolio theory, you had non-correlated assets. And so, if one asset was going up, another was going down, so you own both assets and it moderated your risk in your portfolio. That's just not been the case for a very, very long time. And again, just because of all these monetary interventions, everything we're doing, we're just driving more and more correlations between asset classes, which increases the risk in your portfolio and why you have to be much more focused on managing that volatility risk. Because when it occurs, it's going to hit you. There's not going to be a potential where one asset goes up and another one goes down. They're all going to go up or down at the same time, which vastly increases your risk of portfolio decline during a market sell-off.
Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, as a guy who's been managing capital for decades, how much does that worry you?
A lot. That's our one concern that we focus on almost every day is how to hedge the portfolio.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to a fellow who contacted me who has a fair amount of money, had a liquidity event in his life, and was asking me my advice on how we should think about allocating it. And he had read a couple of books and said, well, I really want to be diversified in non-correlated assets. So, I want to find an advisor that I can put all my money into and he can put them in those non-correlated assets. And I was like, and he was thinking about, selling real estate and other businesses interests that he had. And I was like, wait a minute, you're actually undiversifying if you're putting all that stuff into the market right now, because the correlations are so uniform right now.
Right.
That you got to be very careful if you're going to put it all into paper instruments, that you might actually be concentrating your correlation risk, not diversifying it.
Yeah, no, no, that's absolutely right. And it's a big problem. I mean, you know, and this is why, like, you know, we're always trying to look for some, you know, some measure that we can add to a portfolio to hedge against risk. And there's just not, you know, right now, not a lot of those available other than just outright trying to short against the box, which, you know, is challenging when you've also got to generate performance at the same time. So, you know, I can short against the box in my portfolio, but then I start impeding the performance. And in a market that's just going up every single day, almost, that becomes a much bigger factor for, you know, for client retention. You know, for us, at the end of the day, it's important that we generate return. So, you know, at times we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants because we've got to generate performance, but we've got to pay so much attention to those underlying market dynamics that we're just looking for any break that may suggest that we need to become much more aggressive on risk management, you know, in a day or in a week, whatever it is.
I hate to use this term again, but it sort of sounds like it's you're following the Chuck Prince. We got to dance because the music's playing, but we're going to try to dance as close to the edge of the dance floor as we can so we can hop on.
Yeah, no, it's like being in a crowd. You know, I use the analogy of it's a crowded theater and we're just standing by the door.
Yeah,
So,
exactly.
you know, because you know, when and this is something that everybody needs to understand about the markets. And I was talking about this the other day on the radio show, which is you have to understand the market is a market, and how markets work is they're driven by supply and demand. So you just think about two rooms, right? In one room I've got buyers, and one room I've got sellers. Well, right now, the sellers don't want to sell. So the only way that I can get somebody to sell their gold or to sell their stock or to sell whatever it is asset they've got is I've got to bid that price up to a point to where somebody goes, okay, I'll take that price, right? And so some guy that owns gold, he'll say, oh yeah, I'll sell it at 2100 or whatever the number is. And so he'll sell at that price. Now he gets cash, the other guy gets the gold, right? And so, and they both think they're smart, right? That's the old saying. Everybody thinks they're a genius when they buy or sell. But the problem is right now all the buyers are having to move their prices up in order to find a seller. And so this is like a crowded theater. Everybody's in the theater and everybody's trying to transact business. Well, at some point, what'll happen is that the buyers or somebody on the buy side, a hedge fund, a pension fund, whoever it is, they're going to go, I got to sell. I got to sell for whatever reason. I'm selling because the market's too overvalued. I'm selling because I've got a liquidation issue. Whatever it is, I've got to sell. Well, when he sells, another hedge fund is going to go, oh, crud, I better sell because that guy's selling. So the next hedge fund says, okay, they're selling, I better sell too. So all of a sudden now, I've got sellers, and the sellers that were selling over here are going, I don't want to buy here. I was selling because I thought everything was really overpriced. So that's why I was willing to sell at higher prices, but I'm not going to buy here. And there's an old saying in the market that's very true is that sellers live higher, buyers live lower. And so what happens is, and this is why we see these big gaps that open up in the market sometimes, the markets will be down 2 or 3 or 4% in a day, is because there is no buyer between the current price and wherever the seller is setting, going, I'm willing to buy down here. And so you have these, that's why you have these big gaps in the markets. And one morning you wake up, the market's down 2, 2.5%, because that's that gap between buyers and sellers, and those buyers live a whole lot lower right now. And so we're eventually going to get a correction that's 5, 10, 15%, get us back to the 200-day moving average, because right around that 200-day moving average is where most buyers are living right now.
Yeah, this is why we talk about the criticality of the marginal buyer, because when it's a feeding frenzy, you know, everybody's bidding up at the same time, but the price for a financial asset gets set by what the last person was willing to pay for it, right?
Right.
And kind of often you hear about the greatest fool theory, right? At some point you get to the point where there's a top tick, right? There's one person who's pays that last highest price. But then the next buyer, to your point, might be a lot lower on the scale. He's cooled off, right? And so, you know, when all of a sudden that top marginal buyer who was willing to pay top dollar is removed from the equation, you got to ask yourself, well, where's the next marginal buyer? How close is he? And sometimes it's a big difference, right? And especially if you're at a sentiment shift point. So, anyways, you used a term I just want to make sure that you could define for the audience, because I'm not sure everybody understands. I think most people understand what shorting is, but what's shorting against the box?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, sometimes I use terms I just think I assume everybody knows what that means.
Right. It's my job here to ask when you know.
My apologies. So shorting against the box is, is kind of our terminology, more than anything else. I mean, other people use it too, but let's say that I've got a portfolio that is, well, this is how we run our, I'll just kind of give you inside baseball on how we run our portfolio. So in our portfolio, we have 60% stocks. Now, when the market begins to correct and we begin to trigger certain sell signals, whatever it is, our portfolio will ratchet down from 60% exposure. It'll go down by 25% to 45% exposure. 15% decline is 15. 15% is 25% of 60. If we get further sell signals, that'll go down to 30% exposure. And the most negative we'll get on our exposure. So the world's falling apart. We're back into a financial crisis, right? We'll get down to 20, we'll get down to 15% equity exposure. So that's as low as we will ever go. And the reason we never go to zero is because you can't get back in the markets. When the markets ultimately bottom, it's very difficult to get back in. So you always maintain exposure in your ultra safe, defensive companies, whatever those are. But at that point, if I do want to take exposure to zero, I can do what's called short against the box. My box is that 15% exposure. So I short 15% of the portfolio at that point. I have zero equity exposure theoretically, even though I've got 15% still sitting in stocks.
Right, because you've
So
got that 50% long, but then it's offset by the 15% short, so you're net zero.
big net zero, right? So if you want to, hedge your portfolio, you can say, okay, I've got certain stocks that I'm never going to sell for whatever reason. They're because they're great companies, they've got great fundamentals, whatever they pay a dividend, whatever it is. Well, just short it, whatever percentage that is, you can just short against that, take your net exposure to zero and still maintain those stocks.
All right. All right. Well, thank you for elaborating on that for folks. Let's if we can, let's go to the chart of the S&P just to look at what the general technicals are telling us here. And then I want to use that to get to an article that this guy wrote asking the existential question, do technical measures and valuations even matter anymore?
And that guy's stupid.
You said it, not me.
I wrote it too, but there you go. Okay, so here's the chart.
Yeah, I just want to see. I mean, last couple of times we've seen it, markets seem super overstretched. I want to see if that's still the case.
Yeah, it is. So, your deviation from the 200-day moving average is one of the more extreme that we've had historically. Just to put it in context, markets are around, above 5,200. So to get back to the 200-day moving average, you've got to correct back to 4,600 on the index. So, it's not, just a smidgen away in terms of reversing this overbought condition. And again, retest of the 200-day moving average happened all the time historically. So, I mean, you go back and, I mean, just last summer, we were very deviated from the 200-day moving average and we corrected actually below it by October. And that was where everybody was like, oh my gosh, we broke the 200 a day, the bear market's back. And we're like, no, just be patient, it'll be fine. And that's what it was. So, but again, you can't have a moving average unless you trade above and below that average over a period of time. So we're going to violate the 50 at some point. We're going to retest the 200-day moving average at some point. Now, it doesn't mean next week, it doesn't mean next month, it doesn't even mean this year, but it's going to happen at some point. You can just pretty much bank that that is going to happen. Within a given time frame, you're going to retest that 200-day moving average. So again, it's a fairly decent decline. That'll be a great buying opportunity for to put capital to work in the markets. But right now you're just so deviated from that extreme. Your upside is somewhat limited because you haven't corrected that deviation from the long-term mean.
Okay. All right. So I believe from the last times we talked, the key thing you're going to look for is you're going to look for the S&P to drop down to the 20-day moving average, the red line there. And if it punctures below it decisively, that's going to give you a sense of, okay, game's probably on in terms of some sort of correction.
Correct. And then if we the 50-day moving average is sitting right around 5,000. So, first test of support will be the 50-day moving average. If you take that out, then there's really no support until you get back to, 4,600, 4,700 at that point.
Okay. Let me just ask the bullish side of the question here is, what would it take for that not to happen? What would it take just for things to keep going up here,
Just keep
even
going up.
accelerate?
Anything's possible. You're going to need, more liquidity, obviously, and we have that. The monetary base is increasing. Bank reserves are increasing. They're doing fine. The Fed cuts rates, obviously, that can keep this party going for a while longer. But there is a point, whatever it is, that you are going to get a reversal of magnitude, and it happens throughout history repeatedly. You can't stop it. It's as sure if it's if there's anything sure in life. I'm moving back to 2021 as an example. So this is 2021. This was a period in time where we had $5,000 going to $5 trillion in stimulus payments to households. You had zero interest rates. The Fed was doing quantitative easing at $120 billion a month. So the market was just grinding higher. But even during that grind higher, even though you were grinding higher, you still had 5% corrections all along the way. So you were retesting that 50-day moving average repeatedly along the way. And again, but you stayed pretty deviated from that 200-day moving average that entire time. And so for a year, everybody was like, man, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. The bulls were as bullish as they could get. You had super optimistic, bullish attitudes. And then 2022 came along and, Russia invades Ukraine and the Fed starts hiking interest rates and the party was over, right? And then you lost 25% of the portfolio and you gave back almost everything you gained in 2021. That's the beauty about corrections, is they wipe out a whole bunch of your gains. But again, it's going to happen. You can keep a very long streak in the market. And we had a very long streak in the market during this period of time because you just had so much stimulus, hitting the market. We don't really have that now. We don't have that type of stimulus coming into the markets, but money's just flowing into the market from every conceivable corner that you can imagine. Again, that's why everything's going up. Bitcoin, gold, stocks, you find an asset class, it's going up right now. That's because there's so much money trying to get into assets of any type. That will end at some point. I don't know what causes it. I don't know when it'll happen. There's no way to tell it'll happen, but at some point it's going to break, and then you get these retests of moving averages. Again, just you go back and look at a chart of the markets going back throughout history, and it just happens repeatedly over and over again. So.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that folks were feeling like we were given both the correction scenario and the non-correction scenario equal weight here. But definitely hear you saying, "Hey, look, anything can happen." But based upon your the preponderance of data from your long career, things are cyclical.
I mean, that's how markets have to work that way. They can't just go straight up. They can't. There's just certain laws that apply, into physics as well as to financial markets. And so, you're going to get a correction. Now, again, this correction could be next month. It could be 6 months from now. It could be a year from now. You're going to get a correction at some point. It's just a function of when it occurs and what causes it. My assumption remains is that we're going to have a correction sometime this summer going into the election, because Wall Street is not going to want to be long a tremendous amount of assets going into that election, because you don't know who's going to win. You don't know what policies are going to be after they win. You don't know who's going to control the House and the Senate. That has everything to do with policy making, et cetera. So you don't know what that's going to be. Am I going to get higher taxes, lower taxes, more spending, less spending? And so there's a lot of uncertainty. And so markets are likely going to want to hedge that risk somewhat by taking some gains and raising a bit of cash going into the election. Now, once the election's over, it'll be kind of Katie bar the door again. And I would imagine we're going to get a very strong rally into the end of the year. But sometime this summer, wouldn't be surprised to see that 5 to 10% correction we're talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, look, let's just touch on anything that you want to say about the piece that you wrote there about technical measures and valuations. Does any of it matter? I think we're at a point right now in the markets where we're certainly seeing the animal spirits. We're certainly seeing FOMO, drive a lot of retail money into the market, right? I think you were saying one of the last times you were on here that the percent of retail deployment into the market is near the highest it's ever been. Yeah. I'm curious if you're actually seeing that in any of the people that are like picking up the phone and calling you guys. Are you beginning to see that sort of, you know, panic of like, hey, I got to be in this thing, like get me long NVIDIA or, you know, whatever's hot right now. Like, are you starting to see that kind of just anecdotally?
No. So anecdotally, since we're risk managers, when the markets are really bullish, our phones don't ring as much, right? And the reason is that people get the, and I see this in social media posts. So, you know, I have a Twitter following, I have a LinkedIn page, I have a Facebook page, et cetera. Yeah. So
let me check. I'm going to predict what you're going to say, which is that people feel like this is easy. I can do it myself.
Correct. And, yeah. and invariably, whenever we get into these markets, I start seeing a lot of posts about, oh, it's so easy. You know, why do you need a financial advisor? I can just throw money in the market, make money. I can do it myself. And, you know, this is the great thing about bull markets is bull markets embolden people to invest capital. And the great thing about a bull market is it covers up a lot of mistakes. So, you know, people buy stuff based on some thesis that's generally flawed about why this is going to the moon this time and this time is different, right? And the market, the bull market will cover that flaw for quite some time. Unfortunately, when markets eventually correct, that flaw is revealed in the most brutal of fashions because you lose a lot of money very fast. And so, but I can always tell you when we're getting into these overly exuberant periods of time because our phones don't ring nearly as much at the office. You know, our lead flow slows down a good bit, which has been the case over the last month or so. And that's normal. And actually, we appreciate it because it gives us time to breathe and catch up on, you know, all the stuff that we've got coming in from previous. So, you know, but again, as soon as this market corrects, then everybody goes, oh my gosh, I really messed up and I've messed up my portfolio now. Now I better go get some help. And so then, you know, kind of the whole race, the whole chase to try to get stuff straightened out is back afoot. And we'll see that probably sometime this summer is people will come to the realization that they've once again, you know, made an important mistake in their financial wealth and they've caused themselves a lot of problems.
Yeah. This kind of goes to the heart of why I started Thoughtful Money and why I just repeat so frequently on this channel that the vast majority of viewers out there should be working under the guidance of a good financial professional and can benefit from the wisdom and expertise of that professional because, it, you know, they sort of say like, you know, a bull market's job is to suck as many people onto the ride as it can. And usually it is the novice retail investor that's the latest to the party. And that's generally right when things correct. And it's those people who can afford to lose the money the least. They're the ones that get hurt the most, right? And so let me ask you this. I meant to ask you this earlier. You were saying that everybody thinks they're smart, right? So every market participant thinks they're the smart one in the room.
Right.
I think they all think, yeah, you know, prices are high, but you know, the bulls are running and I'm going to be on the dance floor, or I'm going to be in the theater, but I'm going to stand near the door. Right. And just mathematically 100% of the people can't be the first 5% out of the theater. Right.
That's right.
So, a lot of them won't be right. And I guess my question to you is just what gives you confidence that you're going to be truly one of the first 5% out of the theater, you know, when somebody eventually shouts fire?
Well, there's a big difference between, you know, me and particularly me and Mike in particular and the average retail person is the average retail person is at work all day, right? They're doing their job, whatever their job is. And yeah, they may have their computer open to, you know, a market page or whatever, but this is all Mike and I do every day. So we're watching all these various technical indicators, relative analysis, you know, macro analysis, micro analysis, you know, all this stuff. This is all we do all day long. And so we've got all these signals set up and we're looking for this change in the underlying fundamentals of the market that tell us that it's time to leave the theater. For the average person, they'll figure it out, but they're going to be quite a bit later getting out that exit, you know, because we're watching money flows of institutions. So when those monetary flows change, which most people don't have access to that data, just as the retail person, you know, they're not going to see that change until too late. So, you know, but this is our job. This is what we do. And we spend all day doing it 7 days a week, literally.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, look, I've got a massive amount of other topics for us to get through. I think we're probably just going to make a small dent in it, but it's good because they're all good. And whatever we don't get to, we'll punt to next week. Let's see here. There's some payroll data that came out that I don't think it surprised anybody, which we've been talking forever about how the BLS jobs numbers are super head scratchers. We've railed about how every time there's a blowout number, they revise downwards the historic numbers, right? So Zero Hedge actually just did a really deep dive into some of the latest data series that were just made available by the Philadelphia Fed. And basically it uncovers that U.S. payrolls are overstated by at least 800,000 jobs right now.
Right.
And if you remove that difference, it makes what looks like an incredibly strong and robust job market look a lot less impressive. I don't think that surprises anybody who's been watching this closely like you and I, but it's additional data now that's out there that I think gives validation to that I think very understandable skepticism that folks have had. And the reason why I just want to make sure I underscore this is, as we've talked about many times, I feel like that's probably short of like a totally unexpected black swan style surprise. I think that's the shoe that if it drops can make the biggest difference in terms of the market's expectations of the future. And that's employment, right? Mm-hmm. If the employment situation starts looking at risk, then a lot of things have to change.
Right. Well, and again, this is, you know, so, you know, this is, you know, something we've talked about here recently, you know, full-time employment, which is critical to being able to pay bills and have health insurance and all those type of things. You know, that's dropping sharply right now. And that's not, you know, that's typically a pre-recessionary sign. We just did a report on this a couple of weeks ago, talking about full-time employment as a recessionary indicator. And so this is the second time, by the way, that the Philly Fed has revised down the employment data. So, you know, this is becoming a more common occurrence. Again, you know, the data is not, you know, the data revisions aren't surprising. It's an election year, so everybody wants everything to look good. But, you know, we're just seeing this very big gap. And again, you also see the big gap between foreign born workers versus, you know, native born workers. And it was funny because I just read an article, I think it was in the Washington Post, if I'm not mistaken, don't quote me on this, but a lady wrote this article about, you know, why immigration is good for America. And she noted that, you know, if it wasn't for immigration and these immigrants, you know, having these foreign born workers getting all these jobs, then we wouldn't have near. Yeah, it's a great chart. Thank you. We wouldn't have near as strong of an economy as we have right now. So, see, we need this open border to allow this immigration. And that's, you know, that's not really true. And what I mean by that is not true is that the immigrants that we're bringing in through an open border policy are low wage workers, and that drags down the wage growth just on average. If you add a lot of low wage workers to your roles, that's going to bring down your overall wage growth across the economy. So that's not what you want. Do we need immigration? Absolutely, because we don't have a birth rate, right? Our birth rate is declining. You females are not producing children at near the pace that we need to maintain the economic growth capacity of the economy. So we have to have immigration, no doubt about that. But you want to immigrate higher wage working individuals, people that contribute capital, start businesses, those type of things, because that brings up your economic prosperity and your wage growth. So, you know, it's important. It is important to have immigration, but it's also important to have the right type of immigration into your economy. And that's the one thing that's kind of gotten overlooked with a lot of these recent articles on immigration, trying to make the case of, you know, open borders are great. They're not. And this is what's impeding a lot of the problems that we see with wage growth as well as economic prosperity across the board. In fact, I just wrote an article today. It's on the website right now, talking about the wealth gap in America, and the fact that most people alive today have either been through one or two major, the largest, I should not just major, but the largest bull markets in U.S. history. So if you're a Gen Xer, you have been through the 1980s and 1990s bull market. After that, you've been through this bull market that started in 2009 to present. So most Americans have seen one or two of these major bull markets, and yet the average person has about $100,000 saved up in retirement. What happened to all the money, right? Where's all the money? And the top 10% of the population owns, 90% of the stock market. So, this obviously isn't working to increase the overall economic prosperity of the overall economy. So it's great the stock market's going up, but a very small percentage of the economy actually participates in it.
Yeah, well, no surprise to anybody who's watched any of the videos here that you're stepping up on my soapbox here of the wealth gap here in America. And to your point, Lance, we've had two of the biggest, or maybe the two biggest bull runs. And yet, and you make this point a lot, 56% of Americans can't afford a $1,000 emergency expense. Mm-hmm. We are, quote, living in a paycheck to paycheck nation, this article says, which basically says, look, the spoils are not being shared equally or even remotely proportionately. They are just concentrating into the pockets, the deeper and deeper pockets of fewer and fewer individual or households, and everybody else is really kind of getting the short end of the stick here. And that trajectory has a breaking point at it if we don't find some way to equilibrate things a little bit more fairly.
No, it's absolutely true. And there was an interesting article out by the National Post talking about in Canada, there was a report out by the RCMP that said that the generation in Canada won't be able to afford pretty much anything in the next 5 years. And it's just their economic environment is because of the policy choices they've made, right? This all comes down to policy choices, right? Free stuff and all this other stuff.
You're hitting all of the articles that I identified before.
I wasn't going to mention the name of the article, but but what's talking about is that, these people are going to have a very, very tough time being able to live in Canada. Right. And remember, this is the country that we aspire to be, right? Because they have free government health care. They have free this, free that, free education. And this is the dreams of the liberal left in the United States, which is we need all this free stuff. It doesn't work. It leads to a much lower economic prosperity for everybody when you start doing this. And again, we keep making these very bad policy choices of how we immigrate into the country, what policy choices we make, how we spend money, the debts, the deficits. None of this leads to better economic prosperity down the road. It makes everything worse. It drags everybody to the lowest common denominator. And this is what you're seeing. You'll have those that provide jobs, provide labor, those that provide goods, products, or services. That's your top 10% of the economy. Those are your employers. The bottom 90% of the economy that don't participate in the economy, they just live off of it, are the ones that are most burdened by it. And so you have this mass, and this is the point of the article on Friday. I'll share this one graphic with you real quick here. Let me get to the article.
All right. And while you're pulling it up, I just want to let folks know, about 2 months ago, I interviewed Danielle Park. And I think it was the first time many viewers had been exposed to her. They really liked her. She is based in Canada. We talked a lot about all these issues that you're mentioning here, Lance, and she's basically explaining how Canada is unfortunately highly likely to be a preview of coming attractions to the US and other countries. Yeah. Folks, Danielle is going to be coming back on in about a month. So I've already got that on the calendar. So she will be returning, which hopefully is good news to everybody. And we'll be diving deeply into these topics with her.
Right. And again, Canada is a good kind of a cosmos of where we're headed, but also Japan. Japan has done exactly the same stuff we've done on a scale that's probably about three times the size of the U.S., and their middle class is completely devastated. But here, let me show you this one chart. Actually, I'll show you two because they kind of go hand in hand. This is the share of the income between the top 20% and top 5% of income earners versus the bottom 80%, which is the blue line. So, you know, the share of wealth, the share of income that is generated in the economy is, and again, those in the top 10, 15, 20% of the economy, those are your labor providers. They are the ones that own businesses. That's your, they're the ones that own your companies. They're the ones that provide the jobs. They're the one that provide the services. You want to buy an electric vehicle. It's great. I want to support climate change. I'm going to buy an electric vehicle. Who sold you the product, right? So we transfer your wealth. When you buy that electric vehicle, we transfer your wealth to the person that built that product, right? So that's what we call a wealth transfer system. And that's why we see this in the economy, is that more and more of the migration of that wealth has been transferred from the middle class and away from the poor, who spend almost all their money just to make ends meet. That all gets transferred to those that provide the jobs, the labors, the products and services. And so we just continue to see this. And so this chart goes back to 1967. And you can just see since 1967, those in the bottom 80%, their share of income just continues to decline. And that's because of this generational shift of how we build wealth and using debt and all this other stuff. We just continue to extract that capital and shift it to those that provide those services. They provide the credit cards, they provide the debt payments, all that.
Yeah. So just to avoid, you know, people are saying, hey, you guys sound really anti-capitalist here, right? Couple things. One, nothing could be further from the truth. And right. Secondly, yeah, to that point, we don't have free market capitalism here. We have a very captured system where enough power and advantage has concentrated at the top that those players have reinvested their resources into tilting the field even more in their favor, a lot of by capturing the legislature and Congress and having rules and regulations written in their favor. So it is not sort of free capitalism, which is again allowing this concentration to continue to amplify. So we're not pushing for socialist solutions. But the problem is if you let capitalism get corrupted like this, you then end up with sort of this oligarchic structure. And you need to find ways to break it, just like we have laws that break up, you know, antitrusts, or else you end up with a true oligarchy at the end of the day, right? Which has its own issues.
And again, look, there's nothing wrong with capitalism. Right. Capitalism is operating fine and dandy in America right now. In fact, there's a fairly big protest going on right now. 7 million businesses have been started on TikTok. And so they're kind of all banding together to push back against this TikTok ban because their whole livelihood is based upon the business that they've generated off of TikTok. And if you go into TikTok, there's a ton of people that have, you know, TikTok shops where they build, you know, cutting boards, and they sell cutting boards out of their basement, you know, out of their garage or whatever. And they started this business doing, you know, some type of craft or whatever it is.
It's so funny you say that, just because my neighbor does cutting boards. Literally.
Yeah, well, no, you see all kinds of really great stuff that people have created. I mean, you know, but they've all created businesses. So that's capitalism, right? These people are generating wealth for themselves by taking advantage of capitalism. And what you're talking about, though, is particular, and that's the problem we have right now, is corporatism, which is, you know, look, this is share buybacks. This is, you know, how we extract capital from companies to benefit the few on the inside. You know, corporations that are affecting elections by, you know, lobbying heavily, donating to campaigns, these right. type of things. You know, we've gone through
bailout, favoritism, all that stuff, right?
Absolutely. And passing bills that favor them and restricting. Look, we have tons of regulations in the marketplace, right? In our legal system, we have tons of regulations that are there to make sure that companies don't take advantage of employees, that, you know, all kinds of stuff that goes on. You know, we passed Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, after the financial crisis, we passed Dodd-Frank. And Dodd-Frank was supposed to fix all the problems that we had with, you know, the banks and the financial system and everything that went wrong during the financial crisis. So we'd never have that again. Well, over the next 8 years, those corporations and primarily the banks lobbied Congress heavily to basically defang all of Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is a shell of what it was when it was first passed, because all those rules have been removed or rewritten or extracted for the benefit of the companies that lie. They're like, oh, we can't have that rule. It impedes our ability to grow. And so they pay a bunch of lobbyists to go make this case about how bad this law is, and it gets repealed. And so, you know, we pass these laws to fix things, and then we allow these companies to lobby heavily to override these things. And we can talk about, you know, the high-speed trading. We can talk about, you know, all the things that go on that have been overlooked by the SEC. The SEC is supposed to be looking out for the individual investor and making sure markets operation, you know, operate functionally. But yet we keep having one catastrophe after another, IPOs that go bad, you know, whatever it is, you know, SPACs, all that, that people lose a ton of money because they, you know, it's who's paying to get these things done. And again, that's not the way capitalism is supposed to work. That's not capitalism, that's corporatism.
Okay. All right. We could rail about this the whole way through. So I got to tear myself off that soapbox. Okay. But you know, the way it's manifesting is in diminished prospects for the majority, right? That chart you showed was the bottom 80%, right? Who were losing out, right, over time. we put up some stats there. I just want to mention a couple others. So what happens is those who are running the system, right? They for optics, they will do things to show that, oh, hey, I'm on the side of the small guy and I'm trying to make things right, right? And a good example is, you know, the increase that we've seen in the minimum wage laws. And out here in California, we're just now, the $20 minimum wage for fast food workers is going into implementation, right? Mm-hmm. And so the politicians out here, this was, we're fighting for you, the little guy, right? And of course, now you're seeing the absolutely imminently predictable headlines that we predicted were going to happen, which is that what's happening in the fast food industry? Well, hours are getting cut and people are getting laid off, right? So yeah, if you're a fast food worker who can hold on to your job, and if you manage to not get your hours cut, yeah, then you're better off, right? But getting, you know, laid off gets you zero, right? $20 minimum wage doesn't help you if you don't have a job that's going to pay you that, right? So, you know, we're just seeing companies do the incredibly predictable jujitsu of, well, all right, look, if my labor costs are going up that much, I got to take measures to keep them under control so that I can still run this business, right?
So, well, and it's really a two-pronged thing, right? So as a business owner, if you raise my minimum wage to $20 an hour, I have two choices. I can either charge a whole lot more for the food I provide, right? So now McDonald's, and instead of a burger being $6, it's now $12. Right? Because I got to offset the cost of labor. I can pay anybody anything. I just have to make up that cost somewhere. Either that, or as the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, did a great research paper a couple of years ago when we were all talking about $15 hour minimum wage. And they said the $15 hour minimum wage is fine, but it hurts those at the lowest earnings rungs the most. Because what happens is that business owners, when you move up that minimum wage, just as you're just talking about, they'll either hire fewer people, cut hours, or they'll automate their services.
All right. Well, and they'll raise the prices, which all the low wage workers who eat there can't afford. That cuts into their budget.
Right. And then I raise costs, and then I sell less product because people in general will cut back. I mean, we're seeing this now.
Seeing this now. Yeah. Remember how we talked about like the backlash against tipping? Yeah. You know, like now you're seeing just the backlash against food prices. I mean, I'm seeing this all over. I've actually done a couple of polls on this on Twitter. This seems like a real thing now where people are just like, yeah, I've literally cut my eating out in half or entirely. You know, the buyer is beginning to really go on strike because, I mean, let's face it, who's got $20 to buy a sandwich that cost $8 not that long ago?
Right. Yeah. I made this joke on the radio the other day. I said, you know, inflation's getting bad because, you know, back in the day, you know, strippers would always come up with names that were of expensive items, right? Diamond, crystal, Mercedes.
If you say so, buddy.
Yeah. So, you know, and so, you know, nowadays it's like, welcome to the stage, gas and eggs. And, you know, so it's just, things are getting so expensive that people literally just, you know, they're having to make important decisions. It's not a function of well, I just don't want to go eat because it's too expensive. It's like, I can't go eat because I've got to pay an electric bill this month.
Yeah. Which, right? By the way, has also gone bananas, certainly out here in California, right. I got to tell you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah. So the point here is that, you know, it's of course, as the system gets more and more deformed, it is the regular person who bears the brunt of that. And we're increasingly seeing this bifurcation. You know, your chart had the 80% that was losing. I mentioned a lot, and I think you mentioned it just like 20 minutes ago. Most of the financial assets are owned by 10% of households, right? So we're seeing this increasing concentration that benefited very few, hurt everybody else. And we start to see this manifesting in things like the savings rate right now is below pre-pandemic levels. So we've got an exceptionally poor savings rate right now. There's an article I found, I was going to pull up the headline, but I don't really think I need to, showing that YOLO spending, or what was it called? Doom spending, right? Yeah. Is still very much the norm right now. And they think that this is so interesting. They think that this is a generational mind shift, very similar to what we saw in the Depression, just a carbon copy of it, right? Which is, in the Depression, everybody was so scarred. You had these Depression era babies that, you know, everybody talks about their grandparent who passed away, and then they go up in the attic and there's like tins of flour that they've mm-hmm. secreted up there, right? Because they had this mindset of, I always got to hold on in case we go back into lean times. What's so interesting is the pandemic gave everybody kind of this YOLO mindset, which is like, hey, if we could all die tomorrow and, you know, I might not be able to afford a house in the future or whatever, like I might as well enjoy the present. So as I get a dollar, I'm going to spend that dollar on something that makes me feel good now. I'm going to get my jollies now because I might not get them later. Right. And that's in my opinion, that's sort of a sign of a desperation about one's future prospects, which is, if the future is going to suck that bad, I might as well enjoy today, right?
You know, and that's the problem, though. If you take a look at a lot of those statistics, like, you know, debt to income ratios, savings ratios, those are worse than they actually look like, because those are taking everything into account, right? And so if you look at like household debt to income ratios, they go, well, you know, the household debt to income is down, you know, the household debt to income is a lot lower than it was pre-pandemic because people are in so much better financial shape. You know, that's really just not the case. In fact, that was part of this article that I did on Friday, talking about this. You know, you look at the gap of incomes between the top 5%, the top 20%, and the bottom 80%. The bottom 80% aren't even making enough really to pay for raising a family of four. So if you look at kind of the inflation adjusted costs of living for a family of four in the US, you know, families aren't even covering that right now. And
let me just interject on that, because it's so important. You're talking about 80% of the population right there.
Yeah.
That's a big number. Like, this isn't just like a statistic. This is like, we put five people in a room and four of them are making ends meet.
Right. And so this is median disposable income versus the cost of living, right? So if we take the cost of living back in 1967, we inflation adjust that, that's that black line. And you take a look at median disposable incomes, yeah, they've been rising, but that gap of living cost is having to be filled by debt. And so that's why the debt continues to increase in order to supplant that difference for the bottom 80% between the cost of living and what they're making. And so this is when we talk about debt to service, this is why it's so skewed. If you take a look, the bottom 80%, they're the ones that have the debt that they have to carry from month to month, right? So their debt burden is increasing and they have to carry that debt load from month to month. The bottom 5 and the top 5 and 20%, they can pay off their debt every month. And a lot, you'll hear people say, well, I have a credit card, but I pay it off every month. They have very low debt to income ratios in the bottom 5 and 20%. The bottom 80% have very high debt to income ratios. And so there's that. That's why there's this vast disparity between what happened, you know, and this is why when you take a look at presidential approval ratings about the economy, they're in the tank. I mean, you know, the president's been on the road lately saying, look how good the economy is, right? I mean, we're having record job growth and we're having strong, you know, we had 3.4% economic growth in the first quarter. You know, what are you complaining about? Everything is fine. But yet the bottom 80% are going, no, nothing is going good in the economy right now. And this is why.
Yeah, and that's I really appreciate in the previous chart you showed median, right? Because I think in this story, when it tends to get told in the public space, everybody focuses on the averages, and the averages are skewed a lot higher by the top 20% and the vast amount of wealth that it has, right? So you really have to look at that median, and I'm sure most people know this, but median is basically the 50th percentile person, so the person in the middle of the distribution, right? Yeah, the picture becomes a lot clearer with the median. And the reason why I've sort of been going on this procession here, Lance, is I want to get to a piece that you wrote recently that we mentioned super briefly last time, but we had to kind of punt, which was your article on the retirement crisis that's facing government and corporate pensions. And if you want to pull it up, pull it up. But while you're doing it, I just want to mention let me actually see if I can find this tweet to show real quick. So I pulled this up on Twitter the other day. So this is 401k balances in the US. So it's not all retirement accounts, just to be clear. Although when you look at the full retirement account spectrum, it's not a ton better. 401k balances in the US. So if you look at the median amount that's held in 401k balances by age bracket, it's just god awful, right? At the oldest age bracket, the folks who are closest to retirement, the median amount is only $61,000, right? Now let's be generous and say, okay, well, let's look at the average. Well, the average gets pulled up by all the rich people that have big balances in their 401ks. So the average balance for people in their 50s is $200,000, right?
Which still
So
isn't that, I mean, just you're not retiring on 200 grand.
that's my whole point, right? It's like that's not nearly enough to fund the next 20, 30 years of your life, right?
Yeah, that was actually, so that's actually, that's that right there is actually part of the article I wrote on Friday. Because it's talking about there's this re the Fidelity just came out with a recent report. And there's two very interesting things about Fidelity's report. And it says, Fidelity reports every year how many 401k millionaires they have, right? So you look across all of their 401k, IRAs, et cetera, how many millionaires do they have? So they come out and say, we have 422,000. Well, that was actually less than what it was back in 2022. So 2 years later in 2024, they're almost back to a record, right? Not yet. Now the markets are at all-time high, but 401k balances aren't back to $1 million yet. So not all of them. So that just goes to show you the amount of impact that occurs during a market downturn. But the second thing is that if you look at how many retirement accounts they manage, those 401k millionaires make up how much do you think on a percentage basis of all their retirement accounts? Just take a wild guess.
10%.
How about 1.6?
Okay.
So again, not surprising, right? The top 2-3% of the country really has a vast majority of the wealth. And again, 10% of the
Right.
economy owns 90% of the stock market. So not
Well,
surprising, 401k millionaires make up about 2% of all the retirement plans.
yeah, I was going to say, and what's sad is when you talk about all retirement plans. So my data was just for 401ks. When you go for all retirement plans, it's a minority of Americans that even have a retirement plan,
That's correct.
right? So you're saying of the retirement plans, the millionaire part is just that 1% slice, but that's of only the half that have retirement plans.
Yeah. And I get a lot of emails. It's like, well, Lance, all these people in their 401k plans are putting money in the market. The market's just going to go up forever. We have to understand that, first of all, 50% of businesses have less than 10 employees. So they don't have 401k plans. It's too expensive for them to have a 401k plan. Most of them have no retirement plans whatsoever. So that's 50% of companies. Of the 50% that have 401k plans, only about 50% of employees actually contribute to them. So now you're talking about 25% of all employees actually contribute to a 401k plan. It's a very small percentage of the overall. But this is why we have this retirement crisis brewing, because people are not prepared for retirement when we get there.
So let's get to your piece that you wrote the other day. So I just want to give you the opportunity to flag anything in there. I mean, this is something I've written about and talked about for, geez, over a decade now. But we've got certainly insolvency issues with Social Security. I think mathematically, you know, changes are going to have to happen there. In fact, this week we just had Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, saying retiring at 65 is absurd, right? And, well, yeah. And look, I understand the government has to set out trial balloons, but what the absolute worst person to put out there?
Well, no. So for him, and I railed on it. Look, Larry Fink is my least favorite person on the planet. You know, he did this whole ESG thing that, you know, we revealed right up front was nothing but a money grab by BlackRock because they were charging four times as much for an ESG fund that had exactly 99% correlation to an S&P index fund. And in mm-hmm. fact, the top 10 holdings, the only difference in the top 10 holdings of the ESG fund was they stuck BlackRock stock into the top 10 holdings so that their stock price would go up as people bought the ESG fund, which all benefits Larry Fink. Yeah. So that all fell apart. So now he's been on an apology tour for his ESG debacle. And so now he comes out and he's talking about this retirement crisis. Well, yeah, he's talking about a retirement crisis. They manage $10 trillion, $5 trillion of $10 trillion are all retirement accounts.
Right.
So they're now coming out with new ideas of stuff that they can do inside of 401k plans, like provide you an annuity through your 401k plan so that they can hold on to your retirement money forever and collect fees from you. And this is all about a money grab by Larry Fink and BlackRock. He doesn't care. He could care less when you retire. He just wants to make sure he holds on to that money as long as possible. So if he can move the retirement age to 70 or 75, then that means they can hold on those retirement assets and bill you for that much longer.
Yeah. We could really go down the sort of list of ways in which BlackRock is just, you know,
other than that.
All right, quick little diatribe, but you're making me think of a video I just recorded this week with Jonathan Troussard, who is a financial bubble expert. He actually wrote academic research papers on it when he was at UCLA. And just FYI, Lance, you know, from his perspective, looking at the current market action, he's like, yeah, there's a lot of elements of a financial bubble going on right now in the markets. But one of the things that worried him the most right now is given the Wall Street's hunger, or let me put it this way, the market's hunger for product right now, right? Because as you said, people are like, all right, look, I've been in the Magnificent Seven. What else can I get in now, right? You know, Wall Street is stepping in and selling whatever it can into that froth, right? And he's just like, look, yeah, I mean, just one of his worries is that, you know, Wall Street has this perverse incentive to come up with things that, you know, sound good to the market to add, like, oh, that sounds a cool new innovative product. And he's like, almost all these things are not a good fit for the best interest of the person buying it. And they are all slanted to make, you know, the only reason they exist is to produce fees for these Wall Street salespeople that are selling them, right? And so I think we have to just gird ourselves as investors, because we're going to hear a ton of ideas, like, right, as the pie's growth gets more and more challenging for Wall Street, it's going to get more and more creative and aggressive in marketing to us why we need new whiz-bang innovation X, Y, or Z. And in most cases, I think you get to start from the default perspective of, okay, they're trying to drain me dry here. So where's the catch? Where's the evil in this thing that's being pushed on me?
You should always ask that question is where, you know, where's my money going, right? What am I getting for this? Because again, you know, this is why when there's a lot of demand in the market, we bring companies with really poor fundamentals to make them public, right? Reddit, et cetera. You know, it's like, man, people will buy, you know, people will buy anything. Let's throw this at them. And
well, sure, this SPAC craze taught us that. I mean, yeah, right? There's nothing sillier than that.
Exactly. And so that's what happens. But so, yeah, the problem. So Larry Fink comes out, he makes this announcement that we all need to. But this is the retirement crisis that we're getting into, is that, and we mentioned this earlier, is that our birth rate is falling. You know, we need immigration. We need the right type of immigration, because you got to have people that pay into the system. But, you know, we keep making all these really bad decisions policy wise. For instance, Social Security and Medicare is $174 trillion unfunded liability. And so you have to understand that Social Security and Medicare are, you know, essentially and I'm gonna get in trouble when I say this, but it's essentially a Ponzi scheme because it requires people to pay in so that you can pay the existing claims out. And there is a and there is clear writing on the wall. The Social Security Board itself has already said, look, we're gonna run out of money by 2035 and we're gonna have to cut benefits. And so if this was being run properly, you wouldn't have that problem because actuarially, this is very easy to figure out. If I have this many people paying in over this period of time, and they're going to draw this amount of money out and live for this period of time, I can figure out what that is. And I can make adjustments in my tables so that I can make sure those are funded. But then you come along, you start sticking on all these other people that A, don't pay into the system or haven't paid into the system, but they get benefits from the system. You know, we added wives and orphans and widows and firemen and everybody else over the years.
And it's Social Security disability. So it's not just a retiree. It's somebody who says, look, I have a condition. I can't work. Please pay me.
Yeah. Right. And so they're not paying in, but they're taking money out. You know, this is the problem with the Affordable Care Act and why the Affordable Care Act didn't do what it was supposed to is because you put people with existing illnesses in pools with people that didn't have existing illnesses. So they became immediate drawers from that pool and it flipped the pool upside down and made insurance much more costly. So these are all the bad decisions that we make in Washington trying to help disenfranchise people. And again, you know, you can make the case and the claim and it's fine and there's nothing wrong with it. We want to try to help everybody. I'm okay with that, right? But there's better ways to help people. And the problem now is that we've really created a problem of the survivability of this welfare system as we go forward in the future because your birth rate's falling too fast. You don't have the ability to generate more returns on that money. You know, people have made proposals in the past. It's like, hey, invest that money into the stock market rather than just bonds, you know, to get a higher rate of return. But this isn't just a Social Security Medicare problem. It's a pension, corporate pension problem too.
It's a huge corporate pension problem.
You know, corporate pensions rely on these 7% return rates. Well, the problem is that markets don't return 7% on average. There's a big gap between what an average 7% return is and a compounded 7% rate of return that pension funds need. And that's why there's this big gap between, you know, what corporate pensions need to pay out over time versus the assets that they currently have on their books. And again, and what we're seeing today is, of course, we've got this big spike up in the elderly. They're starting to retire. And now, and from an actuarial basis, we knew this was coming. We said, hey, look, there's going to be 10,000 people a day retiring because these baby boomers are going to hit that age. So they're going to retire. They're going to become withdrawers from the system, not contributors. At the same time, though, the population of young workers is declining. That wasn't supposed to happen. They were supposed to continue going up. So we had more payers coming into the system. Right. Well, also the other problem is that we've now had since 2021, because we sent checks to households, we've had a booming stock market, we've created all these other benefits in the economy. Now, all of a sudden, we don't have 10,000 people a day retiring. We've got a lot more. We've had this big rash of people retire from the system. And this is problematic because from an actuarial basis, this is the nightmare you don't want. On an actuarial basis, I'm saying, look, I get 7% of my money. I have this many people retire. I'm good. If one of those two things don't happen, the bottom line doesn't work. If you have too many people retire too fast to start taking money out, your math doesn't work. If you're not making 7%, your math doesn't work. And pension funds can't go back to employees and say, oh, well, you know, we were banking on 7%, but we can't really get 7%. So we're going to have to, you know, lower that rate of return. Well, they can't lower that rate of return. Because if they lower their rate of return, that's going to require a 30 to 40% increase in contributions by plan participants to offset that. And they don't have it. You know, all of a sudden you say, hey, I need 30 or 40% more you contribute to your pension plan. That sounds great. They don't have the money to do it. So they're stuck at 7. Now you've got too many people retiring. And this is just all snowballing into this potential retirement crisis over the next decade. And heaven forbid, everything is fine for right now. But if we do, for any reason, have a 30 or 40% decline in the market, it's all over.
It's all over. And I've interviewed Ted Seidel, a couple of times in the past, and he's the recipient of the largest pension whistleblower reward. So his like full-time job now is basically going and auditing pensions and finding out, you know, the true health of how they're managing their portfolios. And he says as bad as we can imagine how most pensions are mismanaged, he said it's way worse than that. And part of it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that they can see their actuarial shortfalls in their projections. And so they're like, well, we need to get a higher return, right? So lo and behold, Wall Street shows up and says, oh, well, we've got all these different things we can sell you. And there's private equity and all sorts of great returns off of that. And so he's like, we tend to think of pensions as being in really safe, stodgy assets like bonds. He's like, they're barely in bonds. He said they're loaded up with all this other crap that they were sold, you know, would give them a higher long-term return. And a big issue with a lot of these pensions, especially like the firefighters and policemen and teachers pensions, is, I mean, kind of understandably, the constituents of those pensions say, well, we want representation on the board. So, you know, we want some firemen and some teachers on that board. These might be great firemen and teachers, but they're not great investors, right? So they're there and they're just sort of looking around like, okay, well, what should I do here? And the Wall Street guy who shows up and says, don't worry, this is my world. Let me tell you how we're going to make things great for you, right? They end up making a lot of really bad decisions, either because Wall Street has pushed them into it, or, you know, there's a lot of local players that'll come on and be like, oh, you know what, if we build a stadium, you know, in the state, boy, it's going to create all these jobs and the returns are going to be awesome. And the pension funds tend to really be the dumb money for big projects like that.
Right? Yeah, they do.
So he just says it's so many of these are just ridiculously ticking time bombs.
And it's a shame because, you know, back in the 60s, the 50s, even the 70s, early 80s, you know, pension funds could only invest in bonds. And that was a very simple math. Here's my rate of return on the bonds, coupon, right? Here's my retirees. Very simple, right?
That's the way it should be. I mean, that's easy, right?
But again, this was the same thing with the banks, you know, when this was why we put banks and brokerage firms back together to our demise. But, you know, they lobbied Congress heavily because they figured out if they could get a higher rate of return, right? If they could get 7% by investing in the equity market, because remember in the 90s, equity markets going bananas, we're doing 15% a year in the 90s. So market's screaming higher. They're going, I'm stuck in these stupid ass bonds. Let me get into the stock market. Well, that was great because once they could get a higher rate of return than what they were getting off bonds, it means they could contribute less to the fund, right? So the company no longer has to contribute as much to the pension plan because if they got 7% a year, it made up the shortfall. The problem is they got into the dot-com crash. They had the financial crisis. They haven't made 7% returns. And now they've got all these liabilities. And that's the problem going forward.
So just to your point, if we get that 30 to 40% market drawdown,
yep.
Right? You're going to have huge implications for these corporates, you know, corporations and the pensions plans and the public pensions and all that stuff, which what's going to happen, right? Bailouts are going to be demanded, right?
Sure.
Same thing's going to happen just in corporate America in general, right? Bailouts are going to be, there's going to be so much demand for rescue funds at that point in time. And they very well may all be given here, but I mean, we lived through the bailouts of the great financial crisis. We saw what just happened through the pandemic. And at the end of the day, you know, who pays the price? Well, it tends to be that 80%. Once all the dust settles and the smoke clears, one way or another, whether it's with losses, whether it's with further wealth inequality because the too big to fail organizations and the people that own them get bailed out, whether it's increased cost of living because just so much stimulus was shoved out there, right? My point is I think we just need to expect more of the same, you know, should that indeed happen.
Yeah, no, and it will happen. And you know, yes, we're going to do trillions in QE. And look, during the pandemic, we sent billions of dollars to municipalities to make sure that they were going to be okay, right? So we'll do the same thing, and we'll add another $10 trillion in debt to, you know, the financial system, and the right. Federal Reserve will monetize most of it. And, you know, everybody will get bailed out, you know, for the corporations, et cetera. We'll bail all of them out. They'll be fine. They'll be made whole. And you're right. The bottom 80% will get left holding the bag.
All right. Well, look, let's try to end on some good news.
Yes, got that.
So again, lots we're pushing into next week. But funnily enough, both of these stories are DeSantis stories, and I'm not doing this from a partisan standpoint. They just caught my attention. This one's a little maybe a little bit sensitive. We might have people with different opinions on it, and I'm not necessarily going to say well, whatever. You and I have railed about the deleterious, corrosive, toxic effects of social media on society, especially kids, right? And my wife and I, we had our first kid in 2001, so she basically came of age in that first cohort that was growing up with digital devices, right? And we had to go through the whole, like, when she turned 12, really wanted a cell phone. Did we want to give it to her? And how did we manage that and all that stuff, right? And we were all basically flying blind, right? There was no playbook. There was no previous generation of parents to be able to get best practices from for digital devices and kids, right? We were the cannon fodder, generation of parents trying to figure this out. And I think we can all largely agree right now that social media and digital devices in general have had a huge deleterious effect on our kids, right? Some good, lots of bad. What's interesting is we're now trying to look, we're trying to put a playbook together. And so anyways, DeSantis in Florida, they just banned, they've written a bill banning social media for minors under 14. And look, what I want to applaud here, what I want to laud here is that we are trying to build a playbook. We're going to make mistakes. Maybe this is a bad choice. I don't know. But I love the fact that we're finally saying, look, we're not just ignoring the problem anymore. We're going to start trying to do things to try to address the impact that social media is having on children. Curious to hear your thoughts.
No, we've talked about this before, is that China, it's very interesting, right? So the whole TikTok thing we've got going on right now, this TikTok ban. In China, social media is used, but what is pushed towards the users, science, math, technology, education, those type of things, right? So it's not, their social media is very different, and it's also limited to their users, and particularly to, their younger generation. So they're making sure that a lot of the problems that, they're saying, hey, in the US, you can put whatever you want on there. But in China, here's what we're going to put on ours, right? And it's very focused on science, technology, math, education, and educating their youth that's coming up. And this is, that's the difference that, we don't really pay attention to, is what is it that is, what is it that our children, who are sponges at this age, right? Well, so when your kids are little, 5, 7, 9, 10, 14, they're sponges. I mean, everything's coming in. It's just loading. You're just loading up the computer, right? And you have to think about garbage in versus garbage out. And are we really providing them? It's easy to, stick a kid on an iPad or stick a kid on a phone because I have a lot of time to pay attention to you right now here. Just get on this iPad and do whatever.
Makes the kid quiet. Yep.
And it keeps quiet. But are you really doing that child a service? And that's the thing you've got to think about. And again, it's interesting because when my kids were young and growing up, that was, Facebook didn't come along until 2007, right? So, I mean, social media didn't really exist when our kids were babies. And even when they got to be of age and Facebook was coming around, I wasn't on Facebook. That was stupid. But that was just, we were still outside playing, going outside to play and going outside to do things and those type of things. And we were focusing on educating our children. And so this, my kids were fortunate, they bypassed some of this, right? And they have access to it now, but they understand the differences about what's going on. And so the problem now, though, is for kids that are being born over the last 10 years, this is all they know. And we as parents, we really need to ask ourselves, are we doing the best thing for our children by exposing them to the stuff that comes off of social media? And I think, and to your point, I think there's much more bad than there is good.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I know the libertarians here are going to say, look, we're not for anything that's censorship or government control, and I'm not a fan of either of those by any stretch. But I think what they're trying to do is sort of equate social media now with things like driving and alcohol and cigarettes and things like that, where it's like, look, you have to get to a certain age of maturity, a certain maturity level, before you can responsibly use that stuff unsupervised, right?
And I think, and that's the point. Look, we shouldn't be censoring anything. The government just passed is trying to pass a bill where they're gonna have much more control over, being able to go to a media company and say, okay, you can't post this or post that. That shouldn't be the case, right? We don't want censorship. We shouldn't have access to censorship. You should have freedom of access to information. The issue is you should be old enough and mature enough to differentiate between good information and bad information. And you should be able to make those decisions on your, you should have access to all the information, right? You should just be able as an adult to make that decision between what's right and what's wrong. And kids can't do that. They don't have the experience, they don't have the knowledge base, they don't have the references to work off of to decide whether this information is true or not, or this information is good for me or not. And they don't have that. And so, yeah, we don't let our kids drink alcohol. We don't let our kids do drugs. We don't let our kids, get
Drive.
involved, drive, whatever before a certain age, because we say, they should be of an age to be mentally adult enough to make that decision for themselves. And, we're imposing a lot of things on very young children today that they don't have the ability to make that decision. They don't have the references to make a proper decision. That's the job of the parent to say, no, this is good for you. This is not good for you.
Right. And the fact that social media and much digital content is gamified to actually, manipulate our base human emotions. I mean, they've got no defenses against that at all, right? They're
Right.
just so anyways, I just the reason why I brought the story up is I want to applaud it as a society's first step to say, hey, we're going to try to figure this out. Right, because it's been a massive issue that we've largely just been ignoring. We haven't been taking action in any way. Now, this may turn out to be a bad step or a good step, who knows? But I applaud the fact that we're finally saying, look, we got to do something. Or the second thing, then again, it's DeSantis at the center of this. He just signed a law that allows squatters to be immediately evicted from properties, and this is something that's like been all over the news recently, right?
Yeah, I don't understand this at all. Why this is a thing, I have no idea. If I come home and you're in my house, you're an intruder, and there's a consequence for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, so of course I'm out in California, which is one of the most squatter right friendly places in the country,
See,
probably
I
in the
don't
world.
understand that. I don't understand that. So to be a squatter, right, you have to go. This was back from the 1800s, right? So there's this piece of vacant property.
It actually goes
On it.
back to like medieval England. It goes
Yeah,
back
yeah.
even further.
So, but you go to this piece of property and you build a house on it and you live there for 10 years and nobody ever says anything. And you say, well, I've been here for 10 years. That's the squatter's right, right? Not I'm moving a house today that doesn't belong to me and tomorrow it's my house. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, I mean, this is look. This is a great example of a lot of the things that don't make sense to people right now, right? Like open borders is a great bigger issue, but this is sort of one of those ones where it's like, yeah, like how can I come home, somebody be in my house, and they actually get to stay there, right? And I think at the heart of it is, if the person is claiming that they have a lease, right, that they have that the house has been leased to them, and the cops show up, the cops don't know who to believe. Right. So the cops say, well, it's an issue for the
Show me
civil
the
courts
lease.
then. Pardon me?
Show
Yeah,
me the lease.
but they're basically saying, okay, so two people produce two pieces of paper. The cop's like, I'm not a judge. I can't adjudicate this. So they say, look, this is an issue for the civil courts. You're gonna have to work it out. And of course, the civil courts are so backed up. And in a
Yeah.
lot of these states, there's so many, rights for tenants, legal or not, that even if you go through the court system, you don't necessarily come out with what everybody would think should be the obvious solution, right? So it's turned into this like total epidemic. And actually, to bring up TikTok, I just saw this morning there was a There's an illegal immigrant on TikTok who's basically saying to immigrants outside of the country, hey, come here, because you can basically just get a house, right? You can you can literally just set up shop in these houses. Now, what's interesting is I've also seen some recent social media videos of these like local groups that are just like showing up at a house and basically just ripping the doors off and pulling these people out and changing the locks and not letting them get back in. And it's an interesting solution. It might be a great solution. I'm sure there's some legal implications to it or whatever. My point is I applaud that society, somewhere in society, we're finally saying, you know what, this is just freaking ridiculous. We're not going to let this happen. And if you can show up, you know, with a, the owner proof of deed and, you know, whether or not you indeed lease this to the person who's claiming to be a squatter, the cops need to respect that and they'll remove the people if you show up with them. Because I mean, you've seen the stories in the news over the past couple of weeks where like the homeowner shows up, calls the cops, and then the cops take the homeowner away, you know, in handcuffs, leaving the squatters behind, right? So hopefully this is a step of sanity returning to this market.
Yeah. Well, again, the this seems to be like a problem that is a pretty simplistic solution. Again, if I own the property and I'm paying taxes on it and, you know, all that other stuff, then, you know, if you move into my house, it's theft.
You know, it's total theft. I mean, they should be called, you know, thieves' rights and not squatters' rights that they're trying to claim here. But the problem is again, as I said, the police didn't have a mechanism up until now, and still don't in most states, to be able to resolve this on site. I think that's going to be much more streamlined, given what's, at least it's intended to be much more streamlined now, given what Florida's passed. And again, I'm not making a pro DeSantis political pitch here. He just happens to be the guy at the center of both of these two things. But I like the fact that we're finally taking what seems to be common sense action.
No, absolutely. And I'm hoping that Dan Patrick and Governor Abbott will take lead from that and do the same thing here in Texas.
All right. Well, we'll see. I'm going to hold my breath out here in the People's Republic of California. All right. Trades, sounds like you haven't made any trades.
Nope. Just sitting our hands, letting the market do the work for us.
All right. I thought we'd end on some positive stories versus our regular rants. Not that I don't have rants, but we'll push them off to next week. All right, folks, real quick. Expel squatters from your home and the homes of everybody in your community just to be able to listen to the next weekly market recap between Lance and I, let us know that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And folks, on that note, we are fast approaching 80,000 subscribers on this YouTube channel. Want to get to the 100,000 mark for a couple of reasons. One, you get a nice silver plaque from YouTube. But also it's something that tells the algo to take this channel more seriously. So if you're watching and you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please really do subscribe. Also, just a reminder, the new service on my Substack will be launching next week, what I'm calling Macro Pass, where every week you're going to start getting a free premium article from one of the guests that appear often on Thoughtful Money here. And I'll tell you, folks, the list of people that have agreed to provide their premium article to this audience is nothing short of amazing. I'll walk through the full list next week when we officially launch this, but I wanted to let you know that it's coming. Last point, Lance and I hammered this earlier, so I'll be brief on it. But given the state of the markets, given the froth, given the high likelihood that there is some sort of correction coming at some point this year for the reasons that Lance mentioned, most people watching this should not be flying by the seat of their pants when it comes to, you know, something as important as their future and their financial future and their financial wealth. So highly recommend that you work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor, one who takes into account all the macro and market issues that Lance and I have talked about in this video and that I talk about every week on this channel with all our other guests. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you, great. You really should stick with them. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Lance himself and his team there at Real Investment Advice, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. These consultations are totally free. You get bespoke, personalized advice from these guys about your specific situation. There's no commitment to work with them. It's just a free public service they offer. All right, Lance, as usual, my friend, I'll let you have the last word.
Nope. Well, just expect another probably bullish week next week, and we'll see what happens.
All right. Expect a bullish week until there isn't one.
No, that's it. Yeah, exactly. All right.
That's brilliance, man. I can't believe that's what a lifetime of market experience leads you up to.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for hanging out with me for this one. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.